You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 194 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Aquaman number 60, Batman number 93, Justice League number 47, Justice League Dark number 23, Jimmy Olsen number 11, Batman The Adventures Continue number 6, Green Lantern 80th Anniversary, 100 Page Super Spectacular number 1, Stargirl Season 1 Episode 5, Our Man and Dr. Midnight, and Doom Patrol Season 2 Episode 1, Fun Size Patrol. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, up first for DC news. DC is partnering with Big Bang Theory star Mayim Bialik on a graphic novel titled Flash Facts. The graphic novel is geared towards readers ages 8 through 12. The collection of short stories is curated by Mayim Bialik and aligns with next generation science standards, which provides a helpful bridge between the STEM lessons taught inside the classroom and how these principles affect our everyday lives. Now, Mayim Bialik is an American actress, neuroscientist, and an author. From 1991 to 1995, she played the title character on the NBC sitcom Blossom, and then she later played neurobiologist Amy Farrah Fowler on the CBS sitcom The Big Bang Theory. From 2010 to 2019, The Flash Facts is scheduled for release February 2021 for retail price of $9.99. And I'm sorry for butchering her name. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I think it's a pretty interesting idea for a graphic novel. I think the important thing is that the stories are still engaging, obviously, right? That goes without saying, but like it's an interesting idea, but I think the success of it will be based on, you know, how much of it is that the stories are entertaining, as opposed to like if it's so focused on that, you know, applying scientific methodology and stuff to real life. I thought that that's a bad thing, right? But like,
right,
it could also potentially be pretty freaking boring. So we'll see. I imagine it'll be pretty good. I'll be curious to see how it does. I think, at least on paper, I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, I agree. All right, up next for DC News. DC has indefinitely postponed Brian Michael Bendis and Alex Maleev's upcoming event, Leviathan Checkmate, 6-issue limited series. Promising in the most recent retail mailer that it will be rescheduled to align with upcoming DC Universe storylines.
So we've got to assume that the story is changing somehow, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing too.
I would imagine the main plot of the story wouldn't be changing because Leviathan is Bendis's baby, and I can't imagine somebody else then doing something with it that would mess with that. So my guess is there's at least one character that was supposed to be on the team or will continue to be on the team that's going to have something else be happening to them.
Well, yeah, because they said they're trying to reschedule to line up with other DC storylines. So it could have been tied into Generations, and now it's not going to be.
That's a good point. There's, I think, a real possibility that, like, I'm not saying it's Green Arrow, but, like, for example, let's say there's supposed to be some status quo shift with Green Arrow. they would need to change the title to reflect that. So, you know what I mean? Again, I'm not saying that it's going to be him, but just to use him as an example, I imagine it's either one of those two things or some combination of... It's so weird because they released that one special that felt like it was the start of a series, but was actually just that standalone, right?
Right.
Which was odd because it clearly just read as something that was meant to be read as a part of a whole. It did not read like a one issue thing. So, yeah, I don't know. I would be very curious to know what the changes to the story were, but I don't know that we would know that for some time.
Yeah, and who knows? We may never know it.
I think probably eventually, but it'd probably be at a point where most people might not care anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you could probably get that story out of, like 15 years from now. Bendis maybe not even working for DC anymore. You could get that story out of him.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but will anybody care about this story 15 years? I don't know.
All right, up next for DC News. DC has announced Harley Quinn Black plus White plus Red, a 14-part digital first limited series featuring a whole host of creators, including co-creator Paul Dini. The series will publish in black and white with the addition of the color red in ways unique to each story. The first chapter of Harley Quinn Black plus White plus Red is available now on platforms like ReadDC.com and Comixology, with subsequent chapters releasing digital first on Fridays for 99 cents. DC will collect Harley Quinn Black plus White plus Red physically in the near future.
I have two thoughts on this. First, I think it's a really cool idea. Secondly, this feels a little bit like a test balloon, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
I think they're really curious to see how it does with the, like you said, the 99-cent release, and then compare it to then, does it still sell well or does it sell even better just as a trade? And I think depending on how it does, we could either see them moving to doing more of that sort of digital release stuff, or depending on, again, which part of it sells really well, it may push them further towards doing just trades.
Yep.
On stuff.
So.
I don't know. I'll be curious to see. I imagine it will be successful in one form or the other for sure. It's Harley Quinn, and it seems like not only does it seem like a cool idea, it seems like the kind of idea that would intrigue people to check it out. I imagine it will at minimum do well in book form, if not digital form.
Right. Well, I'm interested in checking it out, so don't be surprised if you see it. Plus, it's only 99 cents, so that's
exactly. Another... Well, that's the thing. So that's a pretty reasonable price. Now, if you don't like digital comics, that's fair. But so this could be interesting because I think there's a chance that it actually does decently well. I mean, it's not going to, you're not going to make bank on 99 cent sales, but
no,
I think it is a good chance it does well. And then if it does, and I kind of hope it does, we might get more like that. I would prefer a world in where we still get hard copy single issues, but the reality is I think they're going to become less common from both DC and Marvel. So if there's a way that we can still at least be getting some version of weekly releases, that would be good. I mean, again, physical stuff so that comic book stores can still exist is the best world, but I don't know. I think there are going to be major changes coming to the American comic industry. I think we're seeing some of that right now.
Yep, I agree. All right, and for our last bit of DC news, DC plans a return to the universe of Sean Murphy's Batman White Knight and a new Harley Quinn spinoff series launching this October. Murphy will co-write the series with his wife, Katana Collins, with artist Matteo Scalera and colorist Dave Stewart rounding out the core creative team.
They had mentioned earlier that this world was that DC had basically contracted him to develop this universe more. So I have to say, I'm a little bit excited that he is still heavily... I was under the impression that some of these spinoffs were going to be light involvement from him.
Uh-huh.
And that's fine. I'm not saying that... Like, obviously, there are other good writers out there. But, that story worked so well, you would want the person that's sort of responsible for creating that world. So I personally am kind of relieved to see that the first spinoff is at least co-written by him. So you're still kind of getting a similar creative vision.
Right. Yeah, I'm excited about that. So, and we saw Harley Quinn in both miniseries already. So we already know a little bit about her. So it'll be interesting what she does in her spinoff series and what other characters we see along the way.
And it's such a natural, I think it's the natural choice for the first spinoff. I mean, she was probably the second most developed character, right? I mean, top three at minimum between, you know, like,
yeah,
Bruce honestly didn't have a ton in the first story. It was really the Joker and then Harley. And then the second one was more about Bruce with, you know, a sprinkle of the Joker and then Harley again. So she's the one I thought was the most, like, consistently focused on across both comics.
Right.
I feel like it's her. Now, each story focuses heavily on either the Joker or Batman, but she's kind of that consistent. So it makes perfect sense that you would spin off into her because she had so much development, and there's a lot to explore, I think, with that character.
Yes, there is. All right, well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Are you one of millions of people worldwide with compulsive geekiness, feeling isolated and alone? Do you wish there were people that understood the thoughts and feelings associated with geeky flare-up? There is hope and a treatment program that can help. Ask your podcast service or ESO network provider if the Nerd Bliss podcast is right for you, or go to nerdblisspodcast.com today. Side effects may include butt hurt, movie quotes, nostalgia, warp speed, becoming for clamped, becoming a brony, appreciation of Cats the movie, pantyhose, asking God what he needs with a starship, donut muffin or bagel, bat shoelaces, improved sense of rhythm, aiming to misbehave, nudity, and random arbitrary lists.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers
for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Aquaman number 60. So the issue opens up with Jackson dragging the Black Manta robot head onto the beach. Arthur wonders if Jackson has lost his fracking mind. And then Jackson and Kali explain that they are going to use it to find Andy. Now the trio are able to get the robot head working, and in conjunction with Aquaman's telepathy, they're able to track down Andy. When Arthur returns with Andy, the gods have decided to take Andy into their protective custody while Aquaman is able to track down who is behind her kidnapping. Now, we see the gods take Andy to Mother Shark to protect, and Mother Shark is very happy to have a living soul in her garden. And then in return, we see Mother Shark revives Mira. Mira awakens, and Volko tells her the only way to get their allies to come together was to proceed with the wedding, which is to take place tomorrow. And I thought this was really weird because you're having a wedding taking place. I mean, they had no clue Mira was going to come out of her coma. That was just weird. But hence, it worked out.
Yeah.
In the city of Dagon, Ocean Master's army continues to grow. We see Dolphin is given the task to talk to Lenura because she has been acting weird. And we see that Dolphin follows Lenira to a secret hiding place where she had been keeping the princess for Ocean Master. And we see Lenira is freaking out because the baby is missing.
I thought this comic was kind of interesting from a storytelling perspective because I think there's an argument could be made that it sort of glosses over a story pretty quickly. But I actually think that's the right creative decision because were you particularly interested in them rebuilding the Manta Bot and then searching the ocean for the baby?
No.
No, right? We really just cared about them finding the baby. So I actually thought it was pretty clever the way it gave us a highlight reel, so to speak.
Yes.
And I kind of like that because I think you very easily could have had an entire issue on them just, you know, setting up for the search for the baby, I don't know that I would have cared that much about it. It wouldn't have been, it would have been fine, right? And we wouldn't have known any better.
Right.
But I don't know. I actually thought that was a smart creative decision in that, because it just, it gave us the highlight reel. Like it didn't just sort of, you know, hand wave it and boom, there's the baby, right? Like they showed the steps, but they still got to the point that we actually care about. And it got us further to the conflict, the more interesting conflict, which is the brewing political situation in Atlantis, not just with whatever Ocean Master is up to, but also the mess with Mira.
Right.
As well. They've been hinting that maybe Volkel's been up to something too. So, and maybe he's not, but maybe he is. I don't know. I like this issue, not because, you know, I didn't think there was anything that like grand in the story itself. It was more just the way it kept focus on, I think what are the most interesting and important parts of the story.
I have to agree with you. It did move the plot along fairly well and not just dwell on them rebuilding the robot, because like you said, that could have gotten stretched out too long.
Right. I mean, and again, I don't think it would have been a bad issue by any means, but I think it would have just been one where you and I were sort of been like, yep, that was an issue. All right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This one kind of felt like that anyway, but it felt more like it was sort of a setup issue, but it very clearly established the next like strong places to go. I don't know.
Now, do you think Andy will stay with Mother Shark for a long time and she might be out of the stories? Or do you think that Aquaman and Mira will get her back fairly quickly after the story arc's over?
It's weird because it makes it, the way that Aquaman says farewell and the whole narration of Mother Shark that's sort of going throughout the issue makes it seem like he won't see his kid for a long time. But at the same time, I find that hard to believe. I can't imagine that we're more than 3 or 4 issues away from a happy ending. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. But that's the impression I got too. I was like, wow, is she going to be keeping Andy for a long time? Or the other thing I thought of was, is she not going to want to give her back up when Aquaman and Mira come to collect?
I don't know. I wouldn't agree with that. I don't think so.
Okay.
Because she's the one that wakes Mira back up. So,
right.
That's too generous, I guess, for somebody to then turn. You know what I mean? I don't know. I would be very surprised if it turned into a conflict with another shark, which, I mean, it could happen, but that would surprise me.
All right. I was just wanting to get your opinion because I had the impression that that could possibly happen. So
I would imagine she would be sad, right? But
yeah.
I don't know. It feels to me like the comic was sort of like, it would suck to part with your kid, especially if they've been missing. But it felt like it was overblowing that in, to a certain extent, not in a negative way, but like making it feel super important. But we're still going to get back to a happy family, I would imagine, within 4 issues at most.
Okay. There's another possibility that could happen with the storyline too. And that's what if Ocean Master wins the crown? What if he replaces Aquaman and Mira? Well, not really Aquaman, but mostly Mira, and they become outlaws. That could be an interesting story too.
I think that would be interesting. I wouldn't be opposed to that. I wouldn't be shocked if we see some sort of Ocean Master success, right?
It'd right.
almost be more satisfying to see that, because his plan, like, he's built up like quite a strong army, quite a strong plan. It would feel a little hollow, I guess, if Aquaman just shows up and just sort of is like, I'm here now and it's resolved. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I would almost prefer to see a coup d'etat. It would be kind of interesting to see that.
Yeah, because once Ocean Master takes power, we could see what his true ruling would look like, and it might not be what the people expected. So it could turn into a really interesting story. It could be you could actually drag the story out for quite a while with Mira and Aquaman fighting to get the crown back. So it would definitely be interesting if they go that route.
It would be. I agree.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Batman number 93. So the issue begins with Batman and the designer discussing designer's plan for Gotham if it had happened all those years ago. So there was five assassins: Deathstroke, Deadshot, Lady Shiva, KG Beast, and Merlin. They were to eliminate the mayor of Gotham, the deputy mayor, the public advocate, the city controller, and the majority leader of the city council. The kills would be made simultaneously, and the assassins would leave Gotham immediately before Batman would be even aware that the plan had happened. Now, Penguin would have had people planted in positions of power to take over after the officials were assassinated, and this would put Penguin over the city politics of Gotham. The Riddler's part in this is he'd cripple the city. His puzzles would lock down every block, but serve its primary purpose of isolating the different police precincts and humiliating Commissioner Gordon. The cops who would agree to work for Riddler would be allowed to pass and save the city, and Penguin's mayor he's appointed would be a Riddler loyalist to the police commissioner and district attorney offices. Now, Catwoman's part of this plan was to be hacking into the accounts of the wealthiest man in Gotham City. And she would have learned that the Wayne Foundation is funded by offshore accounts. With the account numbers in hand, she'd be able to drain their full assets and redistribute them as she saw fit. She'd become the richest woman in Gotham and also becomes the central bank for the criminal empire in Gotham. And any perceived fraud would be backed by Penguin's political power. Now, the Joker's part of the designer's plan was to kill Batman and Robin. And with a united underworld, the designer's final act of establishing the greatest criminal empire of the next generation would show his legacy. Now, the designer's plan, original plan, was flawed because of the Joker. Because the Joker does not want to kill Batman. And no matter how far the designer would have pushed him, the Joker would have wanted to kill anybody and everybody but Batman. And without Batman off the table, the designer's plan would never work. Thought that whole plan was interesting and how that kind of hinged on the Joker. And the designer didn't know the Joker well enough to know that he wouldn't want to kill Batman.
I thought it was interesting. And I also thought it addressed one of the points that we talked about for the last issue was how kind of dumb the Riddler's plan was, right?
Yeah.
You and I were both like, what? How is that the master plan? It didn't really make sense. So it was interesting to see, as we get into this issue, you see that what we are actually seeing enacted was like a horrible cobbled together version of what was supposed to happen. Like it's not correctly pulled off.
No, it's not.
which makes what you see in the previous issues kind of work a little better. It's one of those things where like it's an accurate reading of the Joker, right?
Right. But
at the same time, like, it's not doing anything new either. Like, the whole Joker doesn't want to kill Batman thing is a core part of his character. Yes, I agree. But also, like, yeah, I know that. You know that. I would argue almost everybody reading that Batman comic knew that. And I don't know. I don't know how to feel about it, because on the one hand, it makes sense that that would be the thing that would trip the plan up. But also, like, you're trying to push that this guy really was a criminal mastermind for his time, and yet he couldn't figure it out. And it sort of cheapens it, because then it makes him look kind of dumb, right?
Right. But you got to remember, when he planned all this out, it was when Batman was a lot younger and people didn't know the Joker as well.
Right. Well, yes, I know that. But, you know, but it's nonetheless, while it's not fair to judge him that way, I feel like it's hard for a reader not to be like, well, of course that wasn't going to work. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because you're right. Within that world, yes, he wouldn't have known that. But we, the readers, can't not know. Like, we can't detach ourselves from that knowledge.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So,
the question I had, did they ever really answer how the Joker was doing these dead body things?
No, I was going to get to that. So Batman has a sword fight with the designer and then unmasks him. It's not the designer, it's his corpse. And I was like, okay, how's the corpse doing all this stuff?
Well, and it's the second time we've seen that, right?
Because yes,
the thing that when the corpse, the fake corpse of the Joker,
right,
when Catwoman went to the graveyard,
right, and they never explained it then either. So I don't know how he's animating these. Well, they're not really zombies; the corpses.
I'm assuming we will get an answer for that, but part of me feels like we need some partial answer.
I agree with you.
You know, I don't know, and maybe that's not fair because there will be an answer. Maybe that's meant to be part of the mystery is how the Joker's doing it, but it doesn't feel like it. It doesn't feel like the mystery is supposed to be like, what is the Joker planning? You know what I mean? Like, if the mystery was, how is he doing this thing? Then I don't think I would point it out because it would be clear that that's the point of the story, but it doesn't feel like that's the point. And so I almost feel like there needs to be not maybe the whole answer, but like a partial thing. Like there's some hint on how he's doing this thing.
Yeah. Cause it's very interesting how Batman would sword fight against a corpse and have problems winning. You know what I mean?
Right.
But anyways, this is part of the Joker's plan to break Catwoman before the Joker sets in motion his plan to break Batman. And we see Joker has Deathstroke stab Batman in the leg, which is supposed to take him out of the equation for a little bit. Now, we're going to get into the interesting part, which was I was questioning. We see Catwoman moves all the money from the Wayne accounts into her own. Now, I wasn't sure if her plan was to help Bruce or if she really had devious intentions. And this confused me a bit because, you know, doing something like this could ruin their relationships. Anyways, Catwoman finds out that she has been duped and all the account she put all that money in was drained also. And now the Joker is worth over $100 billion. I wanted to get your take on that. Do you think Catwoman had devious intentions or do you think she was trying to save the Wayne accounts?
I don't think she had devious intentions. I think she was trying to enact whatever her and Bruce had thought up.
Ah, okay. When we hadn't seen that because it was off screen.
Right.
That makes sense.
I did not get a hint that she was trying to do something underhanded, that she was absolutely trying to, I don't know if save the accounts. It almost felt like they were using that opportunity to do something else with that money. I don't know. I feel like we're going to get more about that. I think that's going to factor into the Joker war story.
Yeah.
Obviously the fact that Joker has the money is, you know what I mean? But like, I feel like we're going to get some more to the Batman side of that too.
Yeah. I think you're right. Now that you mentioned that they probably had something off screen, because I was a little conflicted. I'm like, is she being devious or is she not? But it would make sense that Bruce would have some backup plan. And Bruce could even have figured out that Catwoman's account would get drained too, and they have some other backup plan. But for right now, Joker's supposed to be worth over $100 billion.
Which, yeah, and that seems to be part of the main crux of the story. And so I think there will be more answers around that. I don't know for sure what they'll be, but I think not only obviously we're going to see what the Joker's planning to do with that money, but I also think I got the sense that we're going to be fine. There's going to be some Batman side to that, we know from the start of this story that we were reading that he's trying to use that money to rebuild Gotham.
Right.
But part of me also feels like it was, he maybe felt like it was immoral to have all of these shell companies. I'm wondering, Tinian, the writer, seemed to have an opinion about that kind of way to have money, right? It did not seem to be one in favor of it.
Yeah.
So, I don't necessarily disagree with him, but you know what I mean? Like there was seemed like a strong, like, this is a bad thing. And so I got the sense that we're going to see some change to the status quo of Bruce's wealth at the end of this story, if I'm being honest with you. I think there's going to be some change with that.
That could very well be. That kind of seems what the story's about too, isn't it?
I can't imagine. I almost wonder if they're going to try and go the, like, Batman's now poor, like we saw at the beginning of Rebirth with Green Arrow. I don't know. I'm curious how that – I don't think that would last that long.
I don't think so either because that's part of who Batman is, the Wayne wealth. fortune.
I think DC is probably struggling right now because there are obviously a lot of really strong opinions about, you know, people that are that wealthy
right
in real life. And I think they're struggling with the fact that they've got somebody that essentially represents that is their greatest hero. And I wonder if they're trying to figure out a way to make that more palatable to people. And I wonder if their first attempt at that is to make him poor. And I think that's going to be poorly received. And then they're going to have to find another solution to that, which might just be just completely undoing it.
Yeah. I could see that happening. I mean, I don't know how.
I just don't know. I think Green Arrow is a character that could certainly and has worked in the past, not just in, like, that's not the first time in Rebirth that we've seen a poor Green Arrow. He works, I think, as a character like that, because it fits more with what he's doing. Like, he tends to be focusing more on underprivileged crime and stuff like that. Batman, I don't, like, so, like you said, it's so intrinsic to the character. And, like, even, like, we look at the Batwoman show, right? It just, I don't know that it works, the character that doesn't have, like, all the things that he can do and has access to is because of his just globs of cash.
Right. So, yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what they do.
Yeah.
All right. While Catwoman was draining the Wayne accounts, Punchline was battling Harley Quinn. And we see Harley gets her throat cut and dumped into a sewer. Now, I'm sure we know this isn't the end of Harley, but I'm still not that impressed with Punchline. And I kind of agree agree with Harley. She says Punchline does feel like she's a Joker groupie, and that's basically how I feel like she is.
I agree. It felt like it was trying too hard, right?
Yeah.
Like, Punchline has felt like fan fiction to me personally, and it really felt at this issue like, if I imagined somebody trying to create a new Joker sidekick, I would imagine that, especially an inexperienced writer, not that Tinian is, but you know what I mean? Like, if I was imagining an inexperienced fan fiction version of a Joker sidekick, it would definitely include a scene where Harley Quinn and this new sidekick fight and Harley Quinn gets beaten, right?
Right.
I'm like, you know what I mean? And again, I'm not saying that that's Tinian, but that is such a cliched, like, fanfic move to me. That's what it felt like to me as I read it. I was like, I mean, of course. Of course she's going to beat Harley Quinn in it. And then, like you said, and I agree with what you're saying, Harley Quinn is making very valid arguments throughout the whole thing, which shows that Tinian understands why Harley Quinn is not, you know, Joker's sidekick anymore, which then calls into question, so then why are you doing it? It was weird. It was like he was writing his own argument against the existence of Punchline.
Yes. And one of the last things I remember Harley saying is that Joker's eventually going to hurt Punchline. And I could see that happening too. Like, it's yeah, almost like it's foreshadowing it.
The other thing that has felt weird to me is that Punchline feels like she's meant to represent, like, Gen Z young activists in a certain sense, but, like, the angry kind. I don't know if you got that, like, the stuff that she's saying, like, why would I, you know, like, look what all these people are doing to our world. Why wouldn't I feel this way? And it's like, so wait, what are you trying to say here, Tinian? That, like, if you're a young political activist, this is the destination that you're going down. You're effectively a pawn of the Joker. Like, what are we, you know what I mean?
Yeah. What are you trying to say?
I very much got that. Like, he was very clearly trying to, like, make her emblematic of a certain, like, of that generation. He was trying really hard to make her feel, in my opinion, make it feel like a Zoomer. I don't know if you caught on to that, but there's been, both in the Joker special and in this, there's been lines in there that have, like, specifically thrown in that, like, sense of youth anger towards the older generation.
You know what? Now that I didn't see it before, but now that you mention it, yeah, I can see that.
Which, again, the comic books have done this forever, right? They've always kind of tapped into whatever the current political and social zeitgeist is. But so I'm not saying it's necessarily a negative like a negative thing to do it, but it just, I don't know. I'm curious what Tinian's ultimately trying to say with it.
So we might find out more of that as we get into the Joker War too. So,
right.
Cause she's all obviously
this just gonna... reinforces my opinion overall that we're going to see some change to Bruce Wayne's money. Everything about this whole story, I have been kind of getting that sense, but this comic specifically to me with the stuff that Punchline's been saying, I really think DC is going to at least temporarily be doing something with his money.
I can see that too after this issue.
I could be wrong. I will fully admit, if we get to the end of the story and nothing changes with it, I will admit that I was wrong. But I just am really strongly getting that sense reading this story.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League number 47. So the issue opens up showing us that anger is breaking out across the world. Brother and sister are fighting, fan clubs are fighting, and immortal warriors would butcher each other over old grudges. Now, in Tartarus, the Justice League must stop the god Tardius from escaping. And according to Wonder Woman, Tardius is older than the Titans and the living embodiment of hell itself. She explains that every culture tells nightmare stories of a boogeyman to scare children, and the gods have Tartarus. Now, the Justice League tries to fight Tartarus while Flash runs Corrigan to freedom, but they all get captured. We see Superman apologizes to Batman, telling him, "I should have told you first before revealing my secret to the world." And Batman said he shouldn't have let it fester. And then Wonder Woman reminds us that none of us is without fault. Was it just me, or did that feel weird just kind of thrown in there?
I thought the conclusion to this entire story was incredibly stupid. That's just my opinion. To be fair, it makes sense. Like, it wrapped up the story in that you can clearly see that the entire story was essentially just like, it was a parable. It's essentially what we just read. It was anger is not the solution, forgiveness is. And that every problem in the world, that in the real world that we're facing right now, Drew, if we all just forgave each other, it would all go away.
Yep.
It was one of those, like, so overly simplistic and obviously moral lessons. I was like, what? Get over yourself. Sorry. I fully admit I really don't like this writer that much, and so I am immediately inclined to dislike the stories that he writes. But like, are we reading the Justice League, or are we reading, like, you know, some young adult graphic novel Justice League story? I couldn't tell you the difference.
Because by the end, they're all holding hands and singing Kumbaya.
It was so, you know what I mean? Like, it was so, like, that, it could not have been, it literally, like, it could have had, and the moral of the story is literally the only line that was missing. I don't want to say, like, a story where the lesson is that forgiveness is a good thing, is a bad thing. No, sure, that's fine, but you could, there's this thing called nuance that you could try.
The story was fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, but it's all, like, it's the same thing with this whole Justice League thing, but with his run. It's just this hugely overblown story, which is ultimately just resolved by, like, a tiny little thing, right? He goes so over the top in this issue. John is fighting the entirety of the Amazons on his own. You have the rest of the Justice League fighting the devil of the gods, basically. And you have the rest of the world all tearing itself apart, and it's all because one little dude had a grudge. And it's just resolved when he goes, like, I'm over it now. And you know what I mean? Like, it's so ridiculously over the top, and it's all for nothing.
But that's how most of his stories are.
Right, well, yes, but you know what I mean? But, like, that's the frustrating thing. Like, it's not, like, it just feels like thrown together random sort of thing. Like, I feel like it could have been anything. They could have been fighting freaking Mother Shark for all, like, you know what I mean? Like, none of it. You're just, like, pulling stuff out. Like, yeah, there's this Tartarus is an actual thing, and it's the thing even gods fear. And it means nothing. It ultimately meant nothing. That fight meant nothing.
Well, I got some good news for you, Cletus, because starting next issue, it's written by Simon Spurrier and penciled by Aaron Lopresti.
I actually was going to mention that as well. I did know that this was the last issue, and I was immensely relieved.
I knew you would be. All right, let's put this in the past. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Justice League Dark number 23. Wonder Woman, Animal Man, Detective Chimp, and Abby Arcane are in the heart of the Rot. Now, Anton Arcane has shaped the Rot like a body of a beast with himself at the heart of it. Wonder Woman asked Abby to fight Antoine's control of the Rot. And while Abby's doing that, Wonder Woman draws her sword and cuts Antoine out of the Rot. Antoine turns into a bunch of bugs and swarms away. Now, Zatanna is brought back to the Hall of Justice, where Abby and Constantine purge the Rot from Zatanna's body. And when they're done, she's still unconscious, though. We also find out that the vine in the Rot that put Abby into her dreams had come from Woodrow. Now, at the ritual, we learn that all the Guardians must give up their power willingly. And we see John Constantine has Woodrow go first. And then we see Animal Man give up his powers. And then the Rot is next. And when Abby steps up to the tablet held by Dr. Fate, she turns and attacks the Parliament of Flowers, causing them to decay. And from the rotting debris, John picks up a seed and opens a doorway to the green. Thus, Swamp Thing is back, and the trees are growing in the green again. Now, at the end of the issue, we return to Zatanna, who's been slipping in and out of sleep. We see the Rot. We know the Rot has been purged from her body, but she remembers the black infecting her mind. And in her dreams, she drowns in an ocean of it. There is nothing but darkness as far as the eye can see. And then a voice speaks. The trouble with drowning in darkness is that you never quite know which way is up. And Abby awakes after seeing the Upside Down Man. And it says, to be continued.
This is a really good issue.
It was.
Really good. I mean, not only was it a really satisfying conclusion to this various the Parlance of Life story, but it again refocuses the series on the, you know, underlying threat throughout this entire story, which is the Upside Down Man and the evil that he represents.
Right.
And we learn that all of this, you know, everything that Arcane was up to was really, you know, he's acting on the behest of the Upside Down Man. And it's just, I think the horror elements of this comic are really great. What I like about it is that it's the kind of horror that we saw like in Swamp Thing, right?
Right.
Where you have a lot of like some visually grotesque stuff and some stuff like there's some terror stuff in there, but it's not like gore. If that makes sense. So it makes it, that kind of story can work, but I feel like this is the story that can appeal to a wider audience, right?
Right.
That people that maybe aren't into, you know, the more violent side of horror can still appreciate this story, where people that are into, you know, some darker takes on DC stuff. I think it really, I feel like the series continues to hit the sweet spot.
It does. It really does. Well, I thought this was a really good issue, too. I liked how John Constantine tricked Woodrow and, well, not only them, everybody else with his plan to bring back Swamp Thing. And I've been waiting for a while for Swamp Thing to come back, so that was good to see.
It felt like the sort of quintessential John Constantine plot, too, right? Where
yeah.
he looks terrible. He comes out of it having accomplished his goal, first off. Doing ultimately what is a very good thing for the benefit of everyone and having everybody hate him for it. It involves screwing a ton of people over.
Yeah.
Like, that's the perfect Constantine plot.
It is. What I'm sad about is we probably won't see Constantine for a while. And I love when John Constantine's in the story because he always makes it interesting.
I agree, but I don't think he'll be gone for that long. And I also don't think it's that bad because there's such a huge roster of characters. One thing I think this series has done really well is they've sort of cycled their focus. Wonder Woman has been the most consistent, which as it should be, right?
Right.
But everybody else has sort of gotten their turn
so to speak, to be the focus. Like, we had Bobo had his turn for a while. We had Constantine.
We had Man-Bat.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's done. It has managed what is a fairly large roster overall pretty well, and is something I think some other team books could maybe take some notes from.
Yeah. One of the things this title does that the other titles don't do, they don't focus on the whole team all the time. They focus on different characters and follow those different characters for short story arcs. But they weave it into the whole of the story.
I agree. It's the Justice League Unlimited method, right?
Right.
Where you're sort of grabbing different teammates. I think it does a good job of showing what the other characters are up to, but it doesn't feel the need to necessarily give them a plot, which is something that we see the opposite of that. I think we see a lot in the CW shows where they feel obligated to give everybody something to do every week.
Right.
And I think there's something to be said for what this comic does, which is it sort of doesn't apologize for it. It's just sort of like, we're telling a Swamp Thing Constantine story right now, so that's what we're going to do.
Right.
And it doesn't involve Bobo because it doesn't need to. And that's just, he exists, you know, he's still around, but we don't need to focus on him because that's not the point of the story.
I can give you a perfect example, the Oblivion Bar. You can have something happening, like the focus is on Wonder Woman and who she's partnered with at the moment. Could be Zatanna. They're walking through the bar, right? And you'll see Bobo drink. They'll focus on Bobo a little bit. He'll be drinking and something. You know, it was very short. He's around, but he's not the main focus of the story. And then it goes right back to Wonder Woman and Zatanna. That kind of thing. They have a good way of weaving the characters into the story without having to focus on them or on a certain story with them.
Mm-hmm. Something I continue to highly recommend the series. If people aren't checking this out, like, it is, I honestly think, one of the better books that DC is putting out right now in terms of ongoing series. It's been pretty consistent quality the whole way through.
It has. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week, Jimmy Olsen number 11. So the issue opens up with Jimmy Olsen in front of an alien court pleading his case that he has the legal right to be married to his wife. Now,
no takebacks.
Yes, no takebacks. Another suitor has come to Earth to claim her hand instead. So we see Jimmy returns to Earth, and we get Mr. Metamorpho Olsen. And Jimmy and his allies battle against these alien bucketheads. And Jimmy has all sorts of characters fighting with him, including two Jokers, the Red Lantern Cat, Cyborg Jimmy, Swamp Thing, and a Gotham Anvil, a pilot from Gorilla City. And I had to say, I had loved that banner that stated, Gorilla City loves Jimmy Olsen. When the alien suitor tries to get Jimmy to fight one-on-one, he says no, and all his allies attack. I thought that was freaking hilarious.
That was genius.
I know. Because most stories we see like that, the hero will battle one-on-one with the villain. But Jimmy just says no. But he freaking jumps on him. It was freaking hilarious.
It's practical, right? I love it. Yes. It's so practical. And the villain's so mad. He's like, wait, that's not manly. And it's like, but he won.
Exactly. And then even funnier, after all that fighting's over, Jimmy goes up to his wife and gives her annulment papers. You just did all that fighting for her. Then you annul your marriage.
God, the cameos thing was so fun. You had, like, the Philly Fanatic was in the background. Like, it was just, God, I love this series. It's just so ridiculous.
It is. It's fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
We get a really short story of Lex Luthor gloating and taking a picture of the moment he has beating Julian and Julian knowing it. And then we finally get back to the story on who killed Jimmy Olsen. And we have Superman show up to talk to Detective Jones. So I like that we're hinting that Superman's going to be showing up in the last issue. Because I'm wondering what kind of hijinks. Superman being all serious Superman with all these hijinks going around. I'm just expecting the last issue to be really funny.
It makes sense, too, for Superman to be involved, right?
Right.
Like, I think
unsurprisingly, Matt Fraction has done a fantastic job making this a Jimmy Olsen story and not like an excuse for it to really be a Superman story. But it makes sense to pull him in right at the end. It's sort of like, you know, he is still Superman's pal, right?
So. Right. And he also did a good job of sprinkling Superman throughout the series. We've had bits and pieces of Superman without him taking over the comic. All right, well, let's move on to Batman, The Adventure Continues, number 6. So the issue opens up with Lex Luthor telling Slade that he has 24 hours to kill Batman. We see Bruce and Tim are having dinner when the bat signal appears in the sky, and Batman goes alone because Tim's still grounded. Now, when Batman gets to police headquarters, Jim and some of the other cops are unconscious on the roof, and Slade is waiting for Batman. And they leave together to hunt down Firefly. Now, at the library, Barbara finds a note tucked in a book stating that it's a trap. And we see our mysterious person, again, we both think is Jason Todd, leaving the library. Batman and Deathstroke split up. Batman takes down Firefly by himself and finds out Firefly is the girl who's working for Slade. We see Slade attack Batman, and then Batgirl and Robin show up to save Batman, and Batman is able to take down Slade. When Robin and Batgirl explain about the note, they realize that somebody knows their secret identities. So, we're pretty sure we know who that is, so.
I was a little surprised that the Deathstroke story wrapped up this issue. I mean, it makes sense in terms of the pacing of the first two issues we got were like a, you know, a short Lex Luthor story that I argued could have been a single issue. This one, it felt like it was telling a longer story, and it pulled that surprise that it ended up being he was acting on the behest of Lex, and then we didn't get a payoff for that.
No, I think Lex is going to be a threat for the rest of this series.
Is this a mini series? Like, what is the? Do we know how long this is going?
I don't know how long it's going. It's not. I don't think it's ongoing. I think it's just a mini series, or maybe a maxi series. I'm not sure how many issues it's going to be. This is 6 already, so maybe we're halfway through. I don't know.
If it's a maxi series, though, like it's been kind of twiddling its thumbs, hasn't it? Like, for an ongoing, I think it's fine, because there's no end date, you know, I mean, if it gets canceled, but you know what I mean? Like, but for a maxi series, like, what are we doing?
They're telling different story arcs, it looks like to me. We had that robot story arc first, then we had this story arc. Next we're going to have Azrael, but I feel the over...
Like they are wanting to tell, and I agree with you, yes, they are absolutely telling mini arcs, but it feels like they're wanting to tell an overarching story on top of that?
I don't think we're going to see this thing with Luthor end until the last issue. I think he's just going to be in the background. I think he's pulling the strings in the background. That's what I think he's doing. And they're just telling these different arcs till we get to it.
That's fine. That's fine. That's fine. I'm talking in terms of like, it seems like the story it really wants to be telling is this Jason Todd thing. And if that's the case, and again, I don't know how many issues that are going to be in this oral, but if it is 12, like, don't you need to start telling that story at a certain point? I don't know. Well, and then the other thing I wonder is, and we talked about this, I think, was it last podcast, in terms of there's this trend of, because of constant reboots of stories retelling stories. Part of me worries as we're reading this, like, am I just going to read Under the Red Hood again? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hope not. We're getting Batman, the animated version of these characters is what we're getting.
Right, which is good. And I have enjoyed this series, but are we just going to get the Batman, the animated series version of Under the Red Hood?
I hope not.
That's what I hope not. And I don't know that that's what they'll do, but that's sort of the feeling. As we continue to read this, it just sort of feels inevitable that we're going to get a moment. Batman finally figures out who it is, and he's like, wait, what, how? And then, you know, we go in. But, like, you and I already know all of that. That's sort of my problem when you retell these stories. Like, you know, to a certain extent, it's exciting. So you're like, oh, I know this story. But then it's also like, oh, I know this story.
Right. And they could do a different take on it. But
I hope honestly hope they do. it's the animated universe, right? So
right.
I don't need it to stick to what the whatever canon is. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It's its own world.
Exactly.
So I would be totally, I actually hope they do their own spin on it, because that would at least make it, you know, a fresh version, fresh spin on that story.
Right. Who knows? Maybe Jason Todd will be Azrael in this version too. They could do something weird like that.
That's true.
So, you never know. All right, let's move on to our last title for this week. Green Lantern 80th Anniversary 100 Page Super Spectacular Number 1. All right, Cletus. Out of all the 100 Page Anniversary Super Spectacular so far, this has been my favorite. Because I think it was even better than the Catwoman one. We had a lot more... I liked almost all the stories in this one.
I thought the highs were higher. I thought the overall, like the average quality, I still maintain the Catwoman one. I thought had, like, I enjoyed almost every single Catwoman story. This one, there were some I really liked, and there were some, like, I hate to say it, but like the Denny O'Neil one didn't really do anything for me. I thought it was very representative and accurate of that Green Lantern, Green Arrow era of comics, some of which I really enjoy, but that was not a particularly strong one. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know what you mean, because I liked the story, but it wasn't that great. And
I was, absolutely belonged in the collection, and it was incredibly representative. Obviously, it's the same writer,
right,
of that era of Green Lantern. So again, it belonged in that collection. It just wasn't a very good story.
And I have to
so
agree
for
with
me,
you.
There were some really highs. Jeff John, really, you know, really good. And then there was some, like that one, the Denny O'Neil one. Yeah. So I don't know. Anyway, continue what you were saying.
Okay. Now, my favorite story was the Jeff Johns Last Will story. I love that one. It was my favorite one out of all of these. My least favorite was the Reverse Polarity story by Charlotte McDuffie and Chris Cross. And that was the story that was about Jon Stewart and Hawkgirl.
That was rough.
It just wasn't that good.
I mean, it was about nothing, ultimately. Like, it was just like, it was sort of like a This Week on Justice League sort of thing. Like, it's just like, it's almost like not even a full adventure. Like, there was clearly some part of the story that had already happened. And then we caught like this part of it. That was bad. I don't want to talk about it anymore than that. It was just not a very good story, which is a shame, because like, I feel like there are not a ton of like really famously good Jon Stewart stories. And I don't know. I wish there was, I don't know necessarily from a lack of effort, but I don't know. I was hoping his story was going to be one of the better ones, and I would arguably say the worst.
All right. Here we go. I even liked the Vendetti story called 4, where Hal Jordan and Kyle and John met at the bar and told stories about Guy Gardner and later go visit his grave. I thought that was a pretty good story.
I thought it was pretty good. The thing that annoyed me with it, though, was that...
I knew it's coming.
And again, I am inclined to dislike his stories. I thought it was a good... It's a good story for those 4 Green Lanterns. I will agree with you there. What about Jessica and Baz, though? The whole point... The story is literally called 4, right?
Right.
It's basically maintaining that those are basically the Mount Rushmore of Green Lantern characters, which is probably true. I'm not going to, you know, argue that they aren't the 4 most popular Green Lanterns. They are, absolutely. But that was a huge, just like, those two just don't exist, right? And the problem with that is it would make sense, like, Ron Mars's story with Kyle was very, like, self-congratulatory, I thought. Like, man, remember my era, my run on Green Lantern? How important was that? And so that was another one I didn't really like. I mean, it was like one of those things like, yeah, that's fair. Yes, yep, you made Kyle, you know, Kyle, all that. But at least it was representative of that, right? It was representative of that era that story is supposed to be about.
It was.
The 4 story is not. during Vendetti's run, that's post-Johns, so all six current Human Lanterns, because if we're not including Far Sector, but all six that we've seen in continuity, Human Lanterns, existed during Vendetti's run. And we talked about during Rebirth how DC basically just forgot that those other two existed. Like, they just did nothing with them for the most part. This is a major reason why, because you have a guy who was in control of the series for many years, whose story that he chose to write ignores the existence of two of the six Green Lanterns. How hard? Why did it have to be four? Why couldn't it be six?
I can't answer that except for the fact that maybe he was going back to the time when they were all buddy-buddy before Simon and Jessica.
That era is not that big, though, Drew. Like,
I know
relatively
it's not.
Speaking,
I know it's not. I'm just counter arguing you.
Again, I want to be clear. It's not a bad story on its own. It's just one of those things. That's like, yeah. And again, I would agree with the argument that those are the four most popular lanterns. I'm not going to argue that. But like, the world that DC has established is that there are six. And they even include the other two. They give them their own stories. I actually quite like both of their stories. And yet you have a story here that basically maintains that they're not as important as the other four. Like, what the hell? That's my personal takeaway from that was like, wait, I mean, like, either if you're going to continue to have these characters around and try to continue to push them, because it's like Baz, I have to admit, DC has done a horrendous job trying to do something with his character. But Jessica, at the very least, they've tried doing stuff with her. But if you're going to do that, you've got to commit. Like, either commit to it or just don't do them at all. I would prefer not doing that, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can't keep doing this thing where you, like, have Baz exist and use him as, like, the token minority character. And then as soon as you've used him for that token minority character story, you just throw him away again. Like, that's garbage. Do something with that character. And this is, and I don't know. I thought that story was representative of DC's general treatment of its two other Lantern characters.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping the other thing I liked about this issue is I liked the, what do you want to call it? The secret files at the end of the book. We're talking about I love that. And yeah. I liked some of the pinups they had in there too, because it represented some of the other ones. Like, we had a pinup of the Green Lantern and Far Sector.
Yeah, we had Far Sector. We also had Teen Lantern.
Yes, Teen Lantern.
Which I don't have a problem with, but I was also, and I think she's also in the, both of those characters are in the little index at the end that you mentioned as well.
Right.
Which, again, I think she makes sense to include in that sort of thing, but it makes me want Bendis to actually do something with that character. They haven't really. He sort of did a little bit, but again, with that entire series, it sort of just bounces all over the place.
Yes, because he just can't focus on a few characters. He's got to include everybody.
What really
standing around talking
is I can see a world in which somebody else takes that character and does something really cool with it, which I'm sure is honestly partly what Bendis wants, which is respectable. But I'm worried that they'll do something really interesting with it, and then Bendis will get all the credit for making that character. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, well, I created it. Like, yeah, but did you do the story that made it interesting? It's sort of like Rob Liefeld in Deadpool. I know it's a different company, but you know what I mean? Like, he gets credit for creating that character, where if you read his actual Deadpool, it's horrible. that character never would have taken off.
All right. I'll keep my opinions about Liefeld to myself.
But man, the John story and then the Cullen Bunn story after that, where he did Sinestro, which is great. For people who don't know, he had a maybe 25-ish issue run on Sinestro that happened shortly after John's run ended. Those made me so nostalgic for the John's era of Green Lantern. Like, you had Sinestro back as a Yellow Lantern, which is just so much better. That is such a obviously, to me, objectively better version of that character. It is baffling to me that DC would want to undo that.
Me too. I mean, Jeff's run on Green Lantern is some of my favorite stuff. And this issue had me wanting more of that stuff. With the diversity of stories we had in this, I'm like, can we get back to a Green Lantern story with more diverse characters than just focusing on Hal all the time? So, because I miss that.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Johns's run was very Hal-centric. It just, did a better job of incorporating the rest of the core.
Yeah, but I guess, in defense of that, they were also running Tales of the Core alongside that title, where you were getting the other characters too. So, they often tied their stories together. Not that you had to. Not that you always had to read both issues to get the story, but I mean, stuff that was happening in one book, they'd have it represented in the other book too. So they ran concurrent, and I loved it.
Yeah, I would argue, especially up to, like, post-Blackest Night, they start to kind of diverge a little bit, and then they come together at the end of Johns's run again. But I would argue for everything from Green Lantern Rebirth to Blackest Night, like, you can only read Johns's run, but you lose a lot if you don't also read Green Lantern Corps.
Yes.
Like, those two worked so well in tandem. I would argue it's some of the best DC's done in terms of running tandem titles. I don't know who the editor was for that at that time, but they did a great job with that, I thought.
They did.
Man, yeah. They had the artist too. You had Ivan Reis doing the John story, which he was the artist for a large portion of John's run, and that added to the nostalgia. And then you had Doug Mankey did the Cullen Bunn story, and I don't remember if he was on Sinestro, but he certainly was on Green Lantern with Johns as well. Especially a lot, I think, around Blackest Night was when Doug was doing stuff. Man, oh my gosh, I got so nostalgic for the Johns era of Green Lantern. Oh, and we haven't even mentioned it. The Gary Frank drawn Alan Scott story was actually really good.
It was good.
I shouldn't say actually, is it that surprising? Like, it would take, I think, a pretty poorly written story for a Gary Frank drawn comic to be bad, but that was good. I really enjoyed that. And it makes me, I feel like there was at one point we were going to get some John's Gary Frank JSA book. Don't you think?
Yeah.
And I almost feel a little robbed because I'm fairly confident that we're not. And I really would love to read that because I think his art style would be really, really suited to those sort of old school looking characters. And then obviously we know John's affinity for the JSA, but
yeah,
that story made me want to read that story that we'll probably never get to read. And then everything else just made me nostalgic for peak John's era Green Lantern.
Yeah. I wish we could get that back, but alas, it's over. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
We are Nerdlanta.
We got these filters. I think they're called pee poppers.
That's for popping
exciting.
Peas.
For popping all the peas.
Sweaty balls and pee poppers. Always in time.
Can a podcast be a reboot?
Oh, God, absolutely. Yes.
Yes. That's awesome.
We are highly confident at a late hour.
You know, it's just always fun to talk about geeky stuff. And Nerdlanta is the place to do it.
I guess that's it. We played a promo.
That was an awesome promo.
And we're back. Let's talk Stargirl, Season 1, Episode 5, Our Man and Dr. Midnight. So the episode opens up with a flashback to 9 years ago. Rex Tyler, Our Man, and his wife must flee in a hurry. They leave their son in the care of his uncle, Matt Harris, who is not too pleased about the situation. Rick takes his uncle's last name, Harris, and after quick goodbyes, Rick's parents speed away, hoping to get out of town. But before they get too far, the Tylers are attacked by Solomon Grundy, who causes them to crash and die. Now, back in the present day, Rick works on his car and fights with his uncle, who apparently blames him for his financial problems. While walking to school, Rick stops by the tree his parents crashed into and punches it, bloodying up his knuckles. We see Courtney struggle to get up that morning, and she grabs Our Man's hourglass necklace and tries to sneak out of the house with her JSA gym bag. Pat catches her and tells Courtney he believes the late Councilman William Zarek was the wizard from the Injustice Society and that they are the ones who killed him and his family. Now, Courtney also tells Pat that she thinks Principal Bowen is the fiddler. Now, on the road, Courtney and Pat are having a little car trouble, and we see Rick walk by and tells Pat that it sounds like there's an issue with the alternator. Courtney notices that the Our Man hourglass is lighting up and buzzing from her bag in response to Rick Harris. We see Beth follow Courtney and Yolanda at school and learns that both of them are superheroes. Now, after school, Beth goes to Courtney's house and sneaks into her room. And a few minutes later, Courtney finds Beth in her bedroom wearing the Dr. Midnight goggles. The AI of Dr. McNider within the high-tech goggles explains that he can provide information on a vast library of subjects thanks to the Justice Society databank. Beth also learns that the goggles can shift into various spectrums like infrared, night vision, X-ray, hologram, weather predictor, lie detector, and more. Now, Beth tells Courtney she knows she's a superhero and that she saw Courtney and Yolanda at the hospital. And eventually, Rick's name comes up and Beth reveals, thanks to the help of the goggles, that Rick is not Rick Harris, but Rick Tyler, the son of Our Man. Later that night, Courtney, Beth, and Yolanda track Rick to Cindy's birthday party. And once there, the girls find Rick, and Courtney and Beth attempt to explain to him that his father was Our Man, and that Our Man gave Rex super strength for 1 hour a day. Now, Beth tells Rick that his father was a brilliant chemist. Rick decides to find out by putting on the necklace and flipping the hourglass, and of course, we see him get super strength and bend that keg of beer. But Rick's not interested in joining their group, and he takes his dad's hourglass to go do his own thing. Now, Courtney and Yolanda leave Beth behind to go after Rick, who's using his powers to punch a tree, and we see him bend it in half. When Courtney and Yolanda find Rick, he tells them that he's full of anger and hates feeling this way and that his parents died for no reason. But Beth explains that Rick's parents were murdered, and when using the goggles, hologram tech shows exactly what happened. And they all see Solomon Grundy jump out and smash the Tyler's car. And then Rick is basically ready to join the team. The other thing we see in this episode is Principal Bowen appears on the road next to a school bus playing her violin after stopping a semi-truck carrying a dish in it. Now, Principal Bowen continues to play her violin on the road, killing an informant, and then Sharp finishes off the truck driver himself by shooting him. Sorry, there's a lot that happened in this episode.
I enjoyed this issue. Episode.
I did too.
Pretty good.
I did too, and it looks like the season. The purpose of the season is to build the JSA for sure, because we're getting characters quicker and quicker. It feels like.
The thing I wonder, the problem I think that they need to address at some point is I am enjoying watching them build the basically teenage version of the JSA.
Right.
But they're going up, in theory, against the original Injustice Society that we saw was apparently able to completely destroy the original adult experienced JSA. And they're going to need to be able to, you know what I mean, explain how they're going to be. Because one that would assume that they're going to win at the end of the season, right?
Oh, yeah.
I would assume. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. I would be surprised based on the tone of the show if Icicle somehow wins at the end of the season. They're going to need to explain where that jump comes from. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that it's saying that it can't happen, but I do feel like it's going to need to be a better explanation than just like they just wanted it badly and so they did it.
Yeah. So I don't know what they're going to do. And are they going to end up fighting the old Injustice Society, or are they going to have a new team of teen ones put together by the end too?
I think both is the answer to that, because we can clearly see like there's a young, the was it Brainwave?
Yeah.
is his son is clearly developing his powers. We know for sure the mean girl is going to turn into a villain. So I think probably both is the answer, but like they're going to fight Solomon Grundy at some point. And if they don't, then like, then I can't imagine a scenario where they don't fight him because that would be such a horrible plotting decision. I can't even wrap my head around it.
Yeah. I'm sure you're going to have Rick versus Solomon Grundy at some point.
Yeah.
So
at least, I'm looking forward to that.
Yep. Me too. All right. Well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Doom Patrol season 2, episode 1, Fun Size Patrol. So the episode starts off in 1927. Niall's daughter Dorothy is the star of a London freak show where we learn that she has the ability to conjure up beasts. A voice in Dorothy's head offers her a way out by wishing herself free. Dorothy unwillingly permits her creations to slaughter dozens of circus patrons. Now, in the present, the tiny Doom Patrol has taken up residency in Cliff's racetrack, and everyone is eager to return to normal size. But until that day comes, everyone is doing whatever they can to pass the time. We see Jane is using drugs to avoid dealing with her various personalities. Cliff is taking out his frustrations by killing rats. Vic is teaching Rita to harness her abilities. And Larry is doing his best to keep everyone fed while working with Niles to come up with a scientific solution, but it seems like each attempt fails. And finally, Rita suggests that they might need a magical solution. And Niles finally decides to conjure up Willoughby by singing Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter by Hermits Hermits and twirling a pink umbrella. Sorry, I found that freaking hilarious.
Oh, it was hilarious. Because it's so serious, like everything leading up to that, like he slits his hand, he drains the blood, like it's one of those like super serious magical things. And then it just ends with him singing that song with the little pink umbrella. Like it was perfectly Doom Patrol, right?
Where yes, it was.
Oh, man. Hilarious.
So we see Niall offers Mr. Nobody's painting in exchange for a growth spurt. But when Willoughby adds the necklace to the deal, Niall calls the whole thing off. And next comes big trouble because believing that Cliff has really been feeding the rats this whole time, Dorothy decides to do the same. The good news is that she's safe when the gang actually finds her, but she's watching the rats give birth to a litter of tiny gross babies. And the bad news is, and as rats often do, the mother eats the weakest member of the litter. And Dorothy is traumatized by the experience, and it sends her into a creature conjuring tizzy. The only way Niles is able to stop Dorothy's conjuring of scary creations is by threatening to lock her away again. And we later learn that Niles changes his mind about the necklace, and Willoughby returns the team to their normal size. Then, at the end of the episodes, we see Niles puts Dorothy to bed. And once Niles leaves, the creepy voice that we heard earlier comes to Dorothy. And although she turns down its offer, something tells me she'll be blowing out another candle before too long.
Yep. So first thing we should mention is that I honestly was a little surprised to see this, that HBO Max /DC released the first three episodes of this. And it took a lot of restraint to only watch one.
I know. I know. It took a lot of restraint, too.
I didn't want to watch. I know you and I have a similar thing where we don't want to watch ahead because we'll both get confused.
Yes.
When we're reviewing episodes. Man, it was so hard because this was so good.
It was.
I will admit, and I'm curious if you had rewatched the show recently. I had not. And so I felt a little bit rusty. I was like, wait, what's
going on? Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I did not rewatch it either. I went into it and I'm like, why is everybody small? I didn't remember. I mean, my member kind of jogged back to that final episode then, because when they mentioned Dr. or Mr. Nobody was locked in the painting, I was like, oh, yeah.
Actually, so one of the things I thought this episode did really well was, I think it's not a coincidence that our memories were sort of jogged as we were watching. I mean, naturally, that's going to happen anyway. But I thought the episode did a really good job of doing things intentionally to sort of be like, oh, yeah. And sort of like, oh, yeah, okay, that's going to happen.
That's how I was through the episode too, because when they focus on each of the characters and what was going on with them, it jogged my memory back to what happened last season. So I did a pretty good job without doing a recap of refreshing our memories, what was going on. There wasn't really any new menace besides Dorothy's little creatures. It was everybody trying to deal with being small and all the problems, their own problems they always have to deal with. So,
and that's fitting for the show, right? I mean, because right. Mr. Nobody was certainly the overarching villain of the season, without question. But most episodes frequently were mainly just about like their own problems.
Right.
And there were usually antagonists that popped up within that. It feels like whatever the wish monster, I don't know what we're calling it, that feels like that's maybe the overarching threat, to be honest. And I kind of like it. I like how ominous it feels because we don't really know what it is. We know what the other two look like, imaginary friends. But we don't know what that one is, what it does exactly. So I don't know. I enjoyed a lot the addition of the Dorothy character. I think she really adds a nice new element to the show. And I'm really excited by where the new plots are going. Like, I'm curious to see. It looks like Negative Man's going to be doing maybe trying to find out what happened to his family that he left behind.
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
That's going to be interesting. I'm wondering, are we going to see, I think at some point it seems like we're going to get a different dominant personality from Jane.
Yeah, that's what it seems like too.
Which makes me curious, is it going to be the actress playing essentially a different character? Are they going to have maybe a... Well, I guess she doesn't change physically on the outside, does she?
No.
We only see that different... I was going to say, because I wonder if we're going to see, you know, some different...
Different
versions of her. Oh, you know what we did see? She doesn't... The actress doesn't change, but they like her outfits and look changes.
Yes. And her personality.
Well, yes. Yeah. That'll be interesting. You know, that's always interesting for actors too, right? When they get to do something different with the character. So,
if you remember right, she played quite a few different. I mean, she was Jane most of the time, but she had different personalities pop out last season.
Oh yeah, often. I mean the major one was the like housewife, the like murderous housewife.
Yes,
that one was good. And you're right. Addition to others, We talked about this leading up to the season. We were hopeful we would see some new ones. And I don't know. I almost feel like that's what this is setting up, that we might see. I think we're going to get a different dominant personality, and I suspect it's one that we haven't seen yet.
I agree.
Is my guess. I don't know. I would be surprised if they went into one of the already existing repertoire, so to speak, that we've seen. I think it is going to be something new. At least I hope so. I think it'd be more interesting if we get, like, the thing they say is that there's tons of these personalities, and the show did a very good job, frankly, of showing a pretty decent number of them, but there's certainly more that they could show as well.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to a new version of her character. So hopefully one that's more, it's not so negative all the time.
Well, yeah.
So,
and then again, though, like, I don't know, would it be Doom Patrol if it was all, like, it would feel wrong. Like, it was, like, you know, when the housewife one was that weird sort of, like, fake cheerful thing, like, it was unsettling, right?
Yeah.
So, or when she would do the little kid one, it was, like, intentionally unsettling to see.
I have to tell you, I kind of feel a story for, what do they call it, Elastigirl or woman? Because... She's had her powers for like 50 years and still has trouble stretching out to grab stuff, and her face is always drooping.
Well, but she was never really able to like do that on command before. I'm actually kind of excited to see where it goes, because it feels like they're really kind of evolving her character to be, I think, more what we would expect from an elastic type character, right?
Right.
I think it's interesting to show, like, you wouldn't just magically get, you know, especially with Sunday, with the issues that she had going on, you wouldn't just magically get control of this stuff.
That's true.
And seeing her evolution.
It was nice.
Her desire to be a hero was really cool.
Yeah. It's nice to see her perkier this episode, because she's always been, last season she was always depressed.
Yeah.
She was depressed by her predicament.
It's funny because the whole season really was about each of the characters' individual issues and then trying to get over them. And it feels like her and Negative Man are the only ones that really truly grew from those experiences. Like, Jane is very much still in the middle of it, which is fair. Totally fair. But, like, she's clearly not out of the woods yet. Cliff doesn't seem like he's completely, like...
Yeah. Cliff
figured
is...
out all of his stuff.
Cliff is still again, Cliff.
Right, which is fine. Which I'm not complaining about. But, like, it's cool to see some of the characters have actually kind of grown from those experiences. And I think it's also accurate to show that not all of them have, right? That you don't just magically all get better.
Yeah. Now, was Willoughby more of a help last season than he was this episode? I felt like he was more helpful last season.
Well, I mean, and he is helpful on this one. He does what he asks him to do. He just gets
something
that
for
necklace
it. Yeah.
In return.
And I'm wondering what if we're going to find out what's up with that necklace or if that was just a one-off thing.
I'm fairly confident that that was at least in part, if not entirely, responsible for the doctor's prolonged lifespan.
Okay, I was wondering if that was
because remember he gives the necklace up, and that's when the wish monster tells Dorothy that her dad is dying.
Hmm. Okay. That didn't connect when I was watching it, but now that makes sense.
Yeah, well, if we think about in terms of everything we've seen with this show, he should be dead, right? In terms of
lifespan.
And one of the things that we saw in the show, one of the things I really like is the show never sort of explicitly stated these things, but you can sort of start to pick up on it, is all of the characters that he kind of brings in are people that are effectively in different ways immortal. And you can kind of gather that what he's trying to do is accomplish that for himself. I assume I took it for not as necessary. I mean, maybe selfish reasons, but I would argue more so that he clearly believes that his daughter is best kept safe if he's around. Right.
Right.
And the only way to guarantee that she seems to be immortal herself. She's never aged out of being a kid. And the only way for him to do that is if he is also immortal. And so it sort of seems like maybe, you know, like it doesn't feel like a coincidence, the different people that he's sort of collected around him.
Okay. Now, I forget who was talking about it, but I'm pretty sure it was Cliff and maybe it was Jane. They're trying to figure out who Niles mated with to get her daughter. Oh man, that was so freaking hilarious.
On three, say what you think it was.
We didn't get an answer because Niles came around the corner.
I was actually kind of mad that we didn't get an answer. You know, Cliff would have said something terrible too.
Oh yeah. Oh man, I missed this show.
So many great moments. There was a moment that we saw a similar thing in Ant-Man that was both of them were super funny. Where you have this, it looks like some big major thing, and then it zooms out to what's, you know, like the actual world, and it's just a tiny little toy car.
Yes.
Flipping off. You remember, like, an Ant-Man did the similar thing. It was so funny because, like, you just see this major thing and then it zooms out and it's just like it's nothing, right?
I love the slot car. I thought that was freaking hilarious that Cliff had been working on a slot car and they're racing around the track.
him coming back wearing the rat suit.
Oh. That was just to piss Niles off, too.
Oh, that was so funny.
I know. Oh, man. Great moments in this, and I'm glad it's back.
And just as good as it was when it left off, too. And not that that's surprising, but you never know for sure. In between seasons, things can potentially change. But, man, it really just picked up right where it left off. Like, this is... It's so good.
The unfortunate thing is our audience has probably watched all three episodes and they're going to be way ahead in the series. We're going to be talking about it week by week and they're going to be going, guys, we already know this. Oh, well, I guess it'll be fun to listen to what we speculate, huh?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, see how wrong we are about certain things.
All right. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Well, so originally I had been planning on doing some Doom Patrol shout-outs because we got the, you know, premiere this week. But then I read that Green Lantern book, and it just, oh my gosh, Drew, it just made me just miss that era so much. So I gotta recommend Green Lantern Rebirth. It's the beginning of the John's run. It brings in all of the, according to Venditti, the only four lanterns that matter, and plus Kilowog. It's a great kickoff to the series because it's what's responsible for bringing Hal back in the first place, and then his run really just goes from there. Some other highlights from that aren't surprising. People have, I'm sure, read them already, but highlights for me from it, of course, the Sinestro Corps War might be the best part of the whole run. It's so good. And it really establishes the modern take on Sinestro as a villain. And it, again, I cannot emphasize enough, baffling to me that you would undo it. It is such a good version of that character and encapsulate what everything that works best about Sinestro is in that story and in that version of that Sinestro Corps version of Sinestro.
Man, if you go back and listen to our earlier episodes when we're talking about Rebirth and Sinestro's change back to his old costume, then we complained about that for a long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I still feel strongly about it. I get why Snyder did it, because he was really trying to go back to like the Super Friends. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice, sort of, you know, like get what he was trying to do, and that makes sense why you would restore Sinestro to that. But like, God, I mean, I'm sorry, but Sinestro Corps Sinestro is such a better version of that character. It just works better, in my opinion. I am all for change. I know I argue a lot for like mixing stories up, but there are so many stories to tell with that version. I think reverting back is the opposite of what you want to do. That Sinestro was not, in my opinion, to my knowledge and in my opinion, the what I would consider the A-list villain that he became in the mid 2000s, early 2010s. Like because Green Lantern was so popular at that point and as a comic, but like Sinestro became huge, right? And it's in no small part because of that change, like that recreation of that character. He was always, I understand he was always the Green Lantern villain, yes.
Yeah.
But Green Lantern as itself as a character struggled frequently to be popular. There's a reason why things like Parallax happened, why Green, like, the only reason Green Arrow, Green Lantern existed in the first place is because neither title was doing well. And so they shoved the two of them together in hopes that by pairing the two up, they would sell well.
He had a boost in the early 90s. We had the, what was it? The Dawn. They had a couple miniseries, the Dawn series.
Emerald Dawn.
Emerald Dawn, thank you.
Emerald Dawn 2. Emerald Dawn 2, I think, is almost all about Sinestro.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Because it's about...
It's pretty good.
Yes. So... like those stories a lot. I mean, Sinestro's been around for a long time, but...
But that, even that story, so I agree with you, that's a pretty good story, and that's one of the things I actually included in my master's thesis, but that's about the Green Lantern Sinestro, right?
Yeah, you're right, it is.
The villain Sinestro is, I just don't think, in my opinion, and I will admit this is a very subjective, I don't think he's ever been as successful and overall popular as a villain in his purple suit version as he is in his yellow Sinestro Corps suit version.
Okay, I can't argue that. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about a game called Coup. I was curious if you ever played this game before, Cletus.
I haven't, but it's a social deduction game, right? Where you're trying to like figure out who people are.
Yes, it is, and you're trying to kill their cards and stuff. Well, anyways, one of my sons got me the game over the weekend, and we played it. It was fun. I didn't make it to playing DC Deck Building Rebirth yet because we were playing that game this weekend, but I had to shout out about it because it's really fun.
I've heard really good things about it. If people don't know, I am a big board game fan, but usually it's just me and my girlfriend, and Coup is not a game that you can play two-player, to my knowledge, or at least not well.
Yeah, you can play two-player, but it's a lot more fun with a lot of other players. Yeah. So yeah, had fun playing that. So I have a bigger crew to play games with than you do.
That's true. That's very true, yeah.
And we even got my son who who barely plays regular games besides his video games to play. So if that tells you anything. All right. Well, if you'd like to discuss anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line at 317-564-9133. Leave us a message. Or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right. Coming up next week, Cletus and I are going to be talking about the multiverse. Because, honestly, we don't have any comics coming out next week. So, light week for comics. But be assured, we got a lot coming the next week after that. So, plus, we'll be talking Stargirl and Doom Patrol. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go.
You sure this is necessary?
The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone? But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.